This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 19th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born on a Canadian NATO base in Germany in 1961. He grew up in Vancouver and he's been made an Officer of the Order of Canada. He's a member of the Royal Canadian Academy of Arts. Today, Mr. Generation X tells us why. We start with a blast of music. That was Begin the Begin, and it is, of course, the song by R.E.M. and Michael Stipe. And the reason I played it is that Michael Stipe has a very good friend. His friend is Douglas Copeland, who's the Canadian fiction writer and cultural commentator, indeed even cultural icon. He's perhaps best known for his 1991 novel Generation X, Tales for an Accelerated Culture. But he's also a painter, he's a designer, he's all sorts of things. And he's here in the studio with me today to talk about some of those. Douglas, thank you very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Nice to be here.
You're an accidental writer, you say, and it all started because of a postcard you sent from Japan.
Yeah, it's sort of that story of Lana Turner wearing a sweater at Schwab's and being discovered. I was living in Tokyo, and I just sent a postcard to the wife of a friend, and then she taped it up on her refrigerator, and this is long before email, and a magazine editor was at a party and read the postcard and said, "Oh gosh, this guy should be writing for us." And Doug's not a writer. "Sure he is. Read this postcard." So I got the phone call. And 2 days later, I was in Beverly Hills writing about this swindler in the art world. And it was fun and glamorous and easy. And I got this embarrassing check at the end of it. And I thought, okay, this is a very good way to pay my studio bills. And then it just very quickly, within a year, I was writing Generation X in the desert. So it went very, very quickly.
And you had studio bills because initially you were an artist, a visual artist.
Well, I went to art school from 80 to 84, and I was actually beginning to make a go of it. But the thing, I work in sculpture in three dimensions. Painting is expensive. Boy, the moment you expand another dimension, everything costs $500. It's not like being a sculptor is your ticket to easy millions or something. I think in the end, writing would have happened somehow or another, but it just happened very quickly and explosively there.
And as you say, you went off to the desert to write Generation X, which was famously rejected by its first publisher.
That is correct. I feel like a puppy being swatted with a newspaper. It was hard.
But clearly they regret it now.
Ha ha ha.
It must become perhaps slightly tiresome being called the spokesperson for a generation. It's a huge thing to live up to all day, every day.
No, it's always been corny and it's always been embarrassing. It's never been true. I mean, think of it like a spokesman, like everyone got together, put in $10 and then elected me or something. It's just embarrassing.
Do you feel that it's never been true though? Because so many people do identify with that.
Oh boy. I still don't know how to answer that question after all these years. My life is singular. It's sort of strange, and I've worked very hard to keep momentum going or to keep things fresh. I go crazy if I don't learn a new skill every year, if I don't even if it's just something like working with clay or a new computer language or something like that. I remember growing up being told, and I guess you maybe do too, that when you're an adult, you're going to have 6 or 7 careers. But the thing they didn't realize is that those careers would all be happening simultaneously. They wouldn't be sequential, like now I'm finished doing that and I'm going to become this for another 7 years. And I think that's been one of the great surprises of the 21st century, is this sort of the simultaneity and the juggling that goes on. I mean, unless you have a genuine skill like the ability to cook or perform an appendectomy, you're just toast in the new era and you're just faking it in the labor market forever and ever and ever.
Well, of course, your great, great skill is writing, and Life After God, your collection of short stories, was an amazing piece of work, which seems to have got more and more respect as time goes on. Perhaps initially people didn't realise quite how good the book was. Do you think that's true?
It got trashed when it first came out. I mean, I do notice that the more a book gets trashed, the longer legs it has in the long term. It was very, very unexpected, and it was a strange book. Even now, if you look at it, it's very hard to classify with other books, really. I haven't talked about Life After God in public in like 12, 15 years now. Boy, it feels strange. I will say that when I walk by a bookshelf and my books are in it, it feels kind of like driving through an old neighborhood you used to live in, and there's sort of a bit of nostalgia and a little tear in the corner of the eye, but it's sort of a place you no longer live anymore. I've been, believe it or not, working on a book very similar to Life After God. I'm doing that at the moment. And I can't put myself back into the old headspace I had when I wrote that book, because it's been 20 years of experience later, but I can still sort of find the trance. I mean, the thing about writing a book, as opposed to, say, short, like essays, is that you do put yourself in a I put myself in a trance that goes on for 12, 18, sometimes even 24 months. And then you come to the part where you write the end, and the trance is over. And it's like all the people you've been living with for 12 months just went off a cliff in a bus or something, and they're gone. You know, I've got all the characters in my head, all the characters I've ever written about, and this is radio, so you can't see it, but they occupy a slot in my head sort of behind me and to the left. And I can still summon Wade Drummond from All Families Are Psychotic, or his mother, or Kent from Hey Nostradamus. They're all there, but they're not in play. Here's one thing I've discovered about writing that's really wonderful. Well, you know, you wake up in the morning, you're like, oh, I'm awake. Yeah. Oh, God, I've got to pick up that thing. And oh, so-and-so wants. Oh, God. And suddenly your life just turns into a to-do list. When you're writing fiction, instead of going to that to-do list, you instead go to the characters and what are they going to be up to that morning or that afternoon. And it's a nice way to wake up. That's why I like to have a book in play, because I just don't want to wake up to a to-do list.
Do you always have a book in play?
Usually. I call it getting pregnant. You know, you'd be walking down the street one day or what, doing, and like, oh, that's the book. And bingo, you're pregnant. And then 12, 18, 24 months later, it happens. This is a very strange thing to say on radio, but I'm not pregnant at the moment. God.
We were talking about music earlier, and when guests come onto this program, I often ask them to pick a couple of tracks. And with you, it was so easy, because music is referenced in so much of your work, or indeed you have inspired music, or music has inspired you. There's just so much to choose from. The REM track was an obvious one, having dedicated a story in Life After God to Michael Stipe. But The Smiths, of course, another big connection there between you and Morrissey.
Well, we're not friends or anything like that, but there's a 1996 book, novel, A Girlfriend in a Coma. Yeah. What is it with The Smiths? I read that biography, the autobiography that came out with Penguin, was it a year or two ago?
Oh, the one that Morrissey wrote that he insisted came out as a Penguin classic.
Well, good for him. It's just, that's so brand on, isn't it? I just think that, you know, against all odds, you had this like profoundly eccentric, utterly singular voice from this strange industrial town saying all these things and singing these things, which sounded quite ludicrous at the time, but which actually sort of are obviously going to stand the test of the ages. And I just love the fact that he was just this misfit who sort of made it work for him, which I guess is most of the people I have in my life. I did this one disastrous interview with him back in 2002, 2003, 2004. Well, it's all on the internet. It was for a weekend paper here in England, and Morrissey was living in Rome at the time, and would you like to fly over to Rome first class or business class and interview Morrissey? I thought, well, I've never interviewed anyone before, but that sounds like a good way to do it. And my doctor's like, oh, all those time zones here, you'll need these sleeping pills to get you through. And well, thank you very much. And I never really used them. And I started eating them like they were candy. Like, wow, this is so easy to get to sleep. And then the day came for the interview and I was in my room and the phone rang, ring, ring. But Morrissey's bored. He wants to do his interview now. Like, again, brand on. And so I went down. It was in the bar of this hotel. And as I was walking into the room, his head began to get larger and larger and larger, like a parade balloon or something. And then I basically blacked out for the next 6 hours. I have mostly no memory of the interview whatsoever. And I don't know what I said. And, you know, please, Morris, if you're out there listening, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I don't even know what I talked about. And then I bumped into him in the street the day later. And I think he sort of ran fleeing. So,
writer in a coma, perhaps. It's a little bit obvious, maybe, to play girlfriend in a coma. So which other Morrissey?
I think Hand in Glove, because it was their first single. And the lyrics are bizarre if you look at them, but it kind of works. It just puts you in this strange you and me against the world kind of mood, and I love that.
We'll be right back.
That was Hand in Glove from The Smiths. I'm speaking to Douglas Copeland, Canadian fiction writer and cultural icon. Just before that piece of music, we were talking about sleeping pills, and I wanted to talk about antibiotics and your experience with depression, which you've been writing about recently.
I had this very strange experience 4 or 5 years back. I had some dental work, and they gave me this new antibiotic. I've been told not to say its name in the media, so I can't tell you that. I'm sorry. And I took it before I got on a plane. I was going from Vancouver to New Orleans through Denver. And I got to Denver, and something very strange was going on inside my head. And I hubbed and got to New Orleans, which, by the way, is a fantastic place to go. Go if you haven't gone. And I was checking to the hotel, and, oh, I think I want to kill myself. And what? And then, I wanted to kill myself. And it wasn't maudlin. It wasn't melodramatic. It was just this kind of I need to eat something. And my dad's a doctor, and I knew it was obviously the antibiotic that was up. But it lasted 12 hours, and it washed out of my system. And I've never had the sensation since. But what, having had it, I now recognize that if someone is suicidal, it's a genuine thing. It's like being hungry or thirsty or whatever. Mm-hmm. And how they manage to go on with that feeling in their head is a lot of respect for them. So that was odd. Yeah. I never have the right reaction to anything. And I pills just scare me for all sorts of reasons. Why? Oh, because I'm addictive. And there's all these drugs I've never, ever done, never will do. But every year around Halloween or my brother's birthday, I get, if I don't play my cards right, if I don't eat properly, don't go to the gym or do something stupid, I would sort of plummet into the abyss. And it takes months to get out of. And 2 years ago, I had to go to Stockholm in the middle of December, which is, I think, the only city on earth that has no sun, whatever, in the day. And I have to be able to function. I have to be able to function well. What am I going to do? And I went to the local pharmacist, and I spent $199. I think it was called a Luminaire light box, which has a grid of 10 by 15 blue bulbs. Plugged it in, looked at it, ding, and it was gone. It was just the strange, most push-button psychological reaction. And what the hell just happened? And is this temporary? And no, it wasn't. And I kept this thing in my carry-on bag for 2 years, just in case it comes back, it being, the big D. So I don't know if you're out there. If you have something seasonal, these things do work. One thing I learned, though, is that if you look at it, you have to sort of rotate your head so that all of your retinas get exposure to the light. I think that might be what did it. Because your retinas are just basically your brain. It's just a little satellite outpost of the brain. I'll never explain it. It was just the most amazing experience.
Hold that thought, Douglas. We'll be back in just a moment.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at McGlory House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to Meet the Writers on Monocle 24. I'm speaking to Douglas Copeland, So let's talk about Kitten Clone. It's the book all about Alcatel-Lucent. It's an extraordinary book because, as you say in it, it's a company that has no Steve Jobs, nor does it have a CEO who jet skis with starlets. It's only the 461st largest company on Earth. But were it to vanish tomorrow, our modern world would be immediately the worse for its absence. How do you even sell something like that to your publisher?
Actually, Alcatel-Lucent, I've been corrected, is the 505th largest company on Earth now. It went down a bit since I wrote it. It is this weird company that nobody knows about. And that's what makes it interesting, is that no one does know about it. They make and they service and they create the internet. And I don't even think they realize themselves how important they are. But Alcatel is a French name and Lucent is a leftover name from when AT&T had an antitrust suit and they had to break into these little baby companies, and it's just a mess. And then at one point their stock was worth $87 and it went down to 25 cents or something ludicrous. And they've never quite recovered from that. It's this company that at one moment is completely lost in the past, very engrossed with the present, and yet intrinsically connected to our future. And so the book comes in three parts, or the part of them that looks backwards and mournfully, and the present day, which is just a whole bunch of people with wires and cables in an office making things happen. And then the future, which in this book and with the company seems to be in China, which is lots of conversation too.
It's part of the whole Writers in Residence series that's been put out by Visual Editions. So we've had one that was embedded on a ship. We've had this one, and then we've had one within the IMF. Now, you've really creatively written it in the first person. It's in the form of personal accounts. And you start off, though, with the wonderful French couple, Alphonse and Véronique, and the kitten of the title.
Well, I mean, Tim Berners-Lee was asked, "Sir Tim, is there anything about the internet that actually does surprise you?" And he said, "Oh yes, kittens." You would never have guessed that kittens would be the official sort of spokes creature of the internet. And I sort of wanted to take that and run with it. And then, of course, we're talking about the past, present, and future. So I suppose you'd call it, it's a little mini David Mitchell-esque time travel narrative that sort of connects the book together. I mean, I knew about as much about this company as you do when I first went in there, and I was trying to make sense of it, and I was misreading signals at the beginning, then I had to do more research, and then as you read the book, you're sort of on the same learning curve that I was on. It does lead to this sort of awe-inspiring logarithmic ending that takes place in Shanghai, China, as opposed to, you know, Shanghai, Scotland, or Shanghai,
any
Indiana.
Any of those other Shanghai.
I wrote this book on the heels of doing the Marshall McLuhan biography, and I think it was a stroke of good fortune to do one back-to-back on the other, and the net effect is on the readers of both books is like, oh, we are living in this world where the tone and texture of our daily life is more or less based on the unintended side effects of really fast logarithmic technologies. I mean, look what Google's done to the 21st century already. I mean, can you imagine going back to 1993 and like, what is the molecular weight of zinc? And like, oh, I better go to the library, so I'll get in the car or the bus and drive down. And now it's just kaboom.
You have this wonderful phrase, the new neural reality.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that?
Well, there's the 10,000-hour rule. If you do anything for 10,000 hours, it's basically hardwired into your brain, whether it's, you know, making pots on a wheel or throwing pots on a wheel or chopping onions or navigating the internet, which we've all done it for 10,000 hours now. And I do think what happens with the internet is that it's this massive neural homogenizer that makes you and I and you and me, I never get that right, and people living in the middle of Africa and people in Australia all more or less thinking in the same sort of search and click manner, but also all dealing with a common data pool, to the point where I think you might say that, you know, not since there were 200 human beings at middle of the last ice age have we ever been so collectively identical as a species. It's only going to grow more and more so. Is the internet a metaphor for real life, or is real life a metaphor of the internet? It's sort of become irrelevant. Life is the internet now. And we've all sort of realized this, and we're trying to make our peace with it. I was in this hotel in Berlin this past week, and upstairs, I guess you would call it a hip hotel, but not that super groovy hip. And in the breakfast room and the lunch room, every single person there had an MacBook Air or a laptop or an Apple this or a doohickey that. It was like everyone in the room was just going in and out of these portals to other places and coming back in. And I suppose it's the new normal. It's the new etiquette.
Is it a human right, or will it become so?
Well, there's this thing that happened at the end of the book in Kitten Clone, this experience I had that sort of maybe is the answer to that. And I was meeting with the vice president of the Shanghai Communist Party. And of course, he's wearing a Savile Row suit, and his assistant Julia is in like genuine Chanel. And yet he's the vice president of the Communist Party. And we're talking, and he's saying, well, you know, it's our new 5-year plan by 2017, though some people say it's 2020, like every man, woman, and child in China, urban, rural, no matter what their situation, is going to have broadband access. In the remote areas, it'll be about 5 megs per second, probably higher, which is about what I get at home in Vancouver. In the top 10 cities, it'll be 1 gig per second. Second tier cities, maybe 200, which is, okay, that's astonishing anyways. So I've written this McLuhan biography, and of course the medium is the message, and, you know, sir, but have you thought about, you know, the unintended side effects of dumping astonishing amounts of information on a populace in a staggeringly short period of time? And he looks at me and says, like, well, here's the thing, Mr. Copeland. The future of the world is high-speed Wi-Fi everywhere, always, all the time, no matter where you go. It is going to happen. There's nothing you can do to stop it. It is the reality. So if it's inevitable, we might as well get there first. And that's a very good point. You know, is it a human right? I don't know about that, but it's inevitable. It's going to happen. And that's like saying, is air a human right? And I guess it is, and it's going to happen.
There's so much more we could speak about. Just before we move on from that, the issue of net neutrality. Where do you sit on that?
Do I believe in net neutrality? Absolutely. If you want to see how badly it can be botched up on a huge scale, just look at the way internet service is provided in the United States, where you have all these, you know, so-called competitors who guaranteed they all like sleep together on the weekends. Like, oh, we're just trying to provide the most, you know, service possible with, you know, capitalism on our side in the invisible hand. And the service there is just absolutely dreadful. And it's so expensive to the point where it's like a human rights violation. And then you go to a place like Korea, where they're kind of like China, where like, wham, no matter where you go, you're connected. Beware of bait and switch. Like, oh, it's capitalism. Competition will make it better. And there's something weird and anti-logical about the internet, which makes that equation no longer work. It's the square root of -1. And it's the one industry where competition that way is detrimental.
And that, I'm afraid, brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My producer was Claire Urban. Join us again at the same time next week when I'll be talking to the feminist icon Erica Jong. But for now, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.